let's jump straight into some naked neuroscience news with our friendly neighbourhood academics, cognitive neuroscientist Duncan Assell from Cambridge University and perceptual psychologist Helen Keyes from Anglia Ruskin University. First up, Duncan told us about mind wandering. So make sure you're listening carefully.
The authors are really interested in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. And one of the symptoms of ADHD is increased prevalence of mind wandering, amongst other symptoms. But of course, we all know that you don't have to have a diagnosis of ADHD to suffer from mind wandering. It's something that we all encounter. They were really interested in understanding the neural mechanisms behind mind wandering and how that might interact with cognitive skills. So they got 185 young adults. They put them in an MRI scanner and they made them perform a task called an NBAC task. It's a very simple short-term memory task. And periodically they would stop the task and they had a series of questions about how well concentrated the individuals were, what they were thinking about, how hard they were working on the task, what their minds were on. So they had quite detailed information about mind wandering. And these were interspersed throughout the task. And at the end of the scanning session, they also rated the subjects for their ADHD-like symptoms. And what they found, really interestingly, was that those who had high ratings of these symptoms, firstly, they would be more likely to mind wander. So that tells us that indeed it is the case that these things vary naturally throughout the population, even in people who don't have a diagnosis. And they found that those people who did mind wander more, they performed more poorly on the visual memory task, on the NBAC task. And then when they looked at the neuroimaging data, they found that areas of the brain involved in what we call cognitive control, so areas in the frontal lobe and areas in the parietal lobe, the connectivity between these areas and sensory areas, like visual cortex, would drop out periodically. And in those moments, subjects were more likely to mind wander, and that's when their cognitive performance would drop. It's a really nice demonstration of how you can link these sort of higher order symptoms that we all encounter and that are very common in kids with ADHD, linking it to a neural mechanism and then thus to a cognitive outcome, which in this case is visual short-term memory.
What would you recommend somebody would take away from this study?
Firstly, it's to say the mind wandering that we experience as a sort of very higher order phenomena that happens all the time actually has some really basic underlying neurobiology to it that we're starting to understand. Secondly, that it happens to lots of people. And thirdly, that it happens to some people an awful lot. And that's because this neurobiological mechanism is more likely to kick in those individuals.
Helen, any comments?
Yes, so you said they noticed a correlation between instances of mind wandering and the dropping of the connection in the brain areas. So which drove which?
Very hard to say. The way that I would think about it is that it's one process that we can analyze at two different levels. So we can analyze it at a kind of experiential level. So they describe the experience of kind of switching off and zoning out. And then at the same time, this underlying neural correlate can be demonstrated. Now, those two things, I think, go hand in hand. There may be some previous mechanism that causes both, but I think these things are just sort of two halves of the same coin.
Thank you very much. So, Helen, you've been looking into a paper about whether or not we should be wearing helmets, particularly pertinent for people who live in Cambridge. These are cycling helmets. What were this group trying to find out?
They were trying to find out whether wearing a helmet would make you take slightly more risks. And they were measuring this by looking at how you perceived distance between you and threatening objects, or you and non-threatening objects.
What were these threatening and non-threatening objects?
So in a very realistic setting, it was pictures of a tiger or a shark, as you would commonly encounter in Cambridge. That would be the threatening stimuli. Or pictures of safe, non-threatening stimuli, such as rabbits, mice, horses, things like that.
Okay, so this is a lab study trying to replicate behaviour perception when you wear a helmet compared to when you don't when you're cycling. What did they find?
So they found that if you wear a helmet compared to if you wear a baseball cap, you did risk compensate. So for objects that you perceived to be non-threatening, such as horses and rabbits, you actually overestimated the distance between you and them. You thought they were further away, which suggests wearing a helmet made you feel safer, you risk compensated. Some good news for helmet wearers is that this didn't apply for threatening objects. So when there was a threatening stimulus in front of you, you readjusted your risk level, and it overrode that risk compensation behavior, and you saw the threatening object as close to you, similar to people in baseball caps. So people in baseball caps saw threatening and non-threatening objects as quite close to them. People with helmets saw threatening objects as close, but safer objects as further away. They overestimated that distance.
So what should people take away from this with regard to their cycling behaviour? Because I certainly would always wear a helmet.
So it does add to the debate in an interesting way, because it suggests that wearing a helmet can be positive. The general worry in wearing a helmet is that we recalculate the level of risk, feeling safer, and therefore we take more risks. So this study is saying, actually, if a threatening situation arises, you will suddenly recalculate your risk, taking into account that threat, and you will perceive things safely. So the presence of a threat will override that overconfidence, is what this paper is saying. However, it also suggests that if you're not expecting a threat, so if you're cycling along feeling quite safe, you will be a little bit cocky and take those risky behaviours. So they're saying you overestimate distance, you take more risks if you feel quite safe as a cyclist wearing a helmet, whereas you don't do that when you're not wearing a helmet. So you can take from that what you will. On the one hand, it's comforting to know if you wear a helmet, you will recalculate your risk perception if a threat is present. But if you don't perceive that threat, you could be engaging in risk-taking behaviours that you wouldn't otherwise engage in.
And generally, how much evidence is there to suggest wearing a helmet can put us at risk?
So there's quite a lot of evidence coming from both cyclists and drivers. So we know that drivers will give cyclists less space when they're overtaking if the cyclist is wearing a helmet. And we know from numerous studies that cyclists engage in much more aggressive cycling, much more risk-taking behaviour when they're wearing a helmet compared to when they're not.
But is it also fair to say that we do know a cycle helmet can make a vital difference if you are involved in a crash?
If you're in a collision, without a doubt, you need to be wearing a helmet. You're wearing a helmet, it's going to significantly reduce the chance of brain injury. The same is also true, though, for pedestrians and car drivers. So if you're a pedestrian, perhaps you should also be wearing a helmet. And interestingly, on a numbers level, if you're in a car accident, let's say you're a driver compared to a cyclist, if you're both in a collision, the cyclist is going to need the helmet more than you. But on a pure numbers level, with the amount of people that are in car collisions every year, if all drivers mandatorily wore helmets, we would decrease the level of brain injury more than if we ask cyclists to wear helmets, because there's just fewer cyclists. And we would probably think it would be a bit mad to start saying drivers should wear helmets.
Duncan, do you cycle around Cambridge?
I do, and I wear my helmet, and I'd like to think I'm reasonably cautious with my helmet on. I guess it's one of those things where there are probably massive individual differences. There are some people who presumably are such cautious cyclists, they'll be cautious regardless of whether they wore a helmet, whereas there are presumably some people who show a big helmet effect and cycle very differently.
I do insist that my children wear helmets, so I'm a bit of a hypocrite.
Helen Keyes from Anglia Ruskin University ending that interview there, and you also heard from Duncan Assel from Cambridge University. And if you want to read those studies, the references are on the show page on our website. That's thenakedscientist.com/neuroscience.